This is the Politics and More podcast. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to turn things over now to staff writer Andrew Marantz.
So I have a friend whose name is Courtney Martin. She's a writer who used to live near me in New York, and then she moved away to Oakland in California. And right after she moved, she had her first child.
When we moved in, I would do what a lot of, you know, new moms and dads do, which is like strap my kid to myself in the Ergo, walk around and listen to podcasts endlessly and kind of try to figure out what the hell my life was becoming, and kind of catch up existentially to this thing of being a mother. And I would always walk by our neighborhood school, and it was a beautiful place. You know, this is Oakland, so it's just full of beautiful trees and flowers and just felt kind of abundant. But I was also like, wait a minute, like there's like no white kids on these playgrounds. Like, what's up with that? Because if I walk around the neighborhood, I see plenty of white families, plenty of white kids. And then on this playground, I'm mostly only seeing black kids, maybe some brown kids.
So a couple of years go by and Courtney is starting to think about where her daughter, whose name is Maya, is going to start going to school. And so she asks around largely to other sort of gentrifying white parents in the neighborhood and says, okay, so how do I do this? Like, where do I sign up for school?
You got to get in on these tours, and then you're going to go on the tours. You got to like get on the wait lists. You're probably not going to get in, but then you will get in. Like, it was just sort of this like convoluted process. And even at the moment that I asked the question, I was already sort of too late. And like a lot of the tours were already booked. So I was just like, oh my God, I'm already falling behind.
So the school you were describing that has these sort of beautiful playgrounds and very few white kids, that school is how close to your house?
3 blocks.
Okay. And then when you start getting this kind of whisper network advice from the other sort of like white parents in the neighborhood.
Basically, like if I were to get an Excel spreadsheet, which of course I did, from other white and or privileged parents who are saying like, we've been through this 2 years ago, let us help make your life easier. This elementary school called Emerson Elementary would not exist on that spreadsheet. And then if I would actually bring it up, people would say something sort of cloying, like they're really working hard at the school, but it's just, you know, it's not a good fit. It wasn't a good fit for my kid, and it's not a good fit, that school. I remember being intimidated because on greatschools.org, it's a 1 out of 10, or it was at the time 1 out of 10. And that was intimidating to me because I was like, I don't know a lot about how all of this is calculated, but I have a feeling 1 out of 10 is pretty shitty. But mostly it intrigued me. Like, I really wanted to get on the campus. I really wanted to understand what was going on. And I just became kind of obsessed with this thing about, like, here we all are, these, like, white and or Asian American, for the most part, progressive people who have moved here like I did, because I like to think of myself as someone who wants to live in multiracial, like, urban community. And then we're going to very specifically try not to go to the school with kids of color, have our kid go to a school with kids of color.
Courtney is thinking through some pretty big questions here. How can white people live in big cities without living segregated lives? Obviously, not all white people in cities are wealthy gentrifiers, and obviously not all people of color are poor, but American history is American history, and the inequities in American schools and American cities are very real. So given all that, when you're a white parent of young children, which is a category that includes myself too, by the way, where should you send your kids to school? These are exactly the questions that Courtney just wrote about in her new book, which is called Learning in Public. It's potentially slightly weird that we are two white people talking about the racial politics of education. I think you make a case in your book for why you actually think it makes sense for white people to take on some of the burden of talking about race in this country and why whiteness should be seen as a racial identity. But I just wanted to name that because it is a thing. And then I wanted to ask you if you thought, you know, various people in the book say to you at various times, don't make your kid into an experiment. You know, don't send your kid to a bad school, a failing school, just so you can feel woke or feel like you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. And
did that affect you? Like, did you ever think, oh no, maybe I am sort of using my kid as an experiment somehow?
I think it did. I did always have some instinct that like that was kind of bullshit because it's like this whole thing is an experiment. I mean, all of us are experimenting. That's why we all have to go to therapy when we grow up, is that like none of us as parents know what the hell we're doing. And we're just trying. Like what we feed our kid is an experiment. Where we live is an experiment. Who we befriend is an experiment. Like it's all an experiment from my perspective. So that I think had a little less weight for me. The thing that really I think eventually kept me up is like, am I making my kid into a political statement? Am I like, you know, performing my own political ego through the choice of where I send my kid to school? Mm-hmm. That weighs heavily on me still. And, you know, a lot of the book is about, you know, trying to say, as white interprivileged people, how do we like move away from the performance of anti-racism and like going to the right protests and saying the right things on social media and reading the right books and, you know, all these very well-intentioned things and actually live differently, which I feel like is most of what we have in the culture right now is just so performative. And then I was reading this piece this weekend that was like, why like talking about race with your kid is like not bad for them. And it was like these different bullets that were like, curate your kid's library to make sure there are kids of color and encourage your kids to make friends of other races. And I was like, A, like this is just so trite and like could have been written in 1982 or whatever, but also like, that's so weird and exhausting to be like in your white life thinking, if I'm going to be a good person and if I'm going to raise a good kid, I need to find a black friend for them. Not to mention myself, like that there's this sort of like, that is weird. Like I would be uncomfortable. Like that's very uncomfortable. And I think that is where a lot of people are at, where like their lives are so segregated, but they do have a very real moral inclination to do something. And so then they're sort of stuck in this weird gap of like what they're being told, which is like, you don't actually have to live differently or like give up anything.
So like, how did you think about whether you should follow the advice to sort of like write this school off? Or how did you sort of come around to deciding not to do that?
Well, I think it was a combination of my journalistic approach, which is I started to research not specifically this school, but the question around like integration and equity and like what do we actually know about what it means to have white kids on a campus like Emerson. So I ended up, you know, of course, reading and listening to a lot of Nicole Hannah-Jones' work and then getting led to like this professor at Berkeley, Rucker C. Johnson, who's done this vast amount of research longitudinally and in terms of the amount of data about how integration affects kids, and learned that, yes, integration is the best tool we have for making sure there's more educational equity, that black and brown kids, the earlier they're in integrated schools and the longer they're in integrated schools, do everything from like better test scores, better graduation rates, to living longer, to like having longer earning potential, like all of this crazy shit. And that white kids do fine and also have extra, you know, social emotional skills because they've been collaborating with and befriending kids who don't, you know, come from the same background as them. So that research was really convincing. But then I had to do like the emotional convincing of myself, you know, to like walk onto the campus, look around, just like say, How do I feel? How do I feel like my kid Maya would feel in this setting?
So, okay, so you wrestle with it, you think about it, and you decide, okay, we're gonna send our kid to this 1 out of 10 elementary school. And as you write about in the book, you end up having a great experience. And, you know, you think maybe we're giving up on a little bit of educational advantage that we could get from another school, but maybe not. Maybe she's learning just as much as she would somewhere else. And yet there's this other element to it that's kind of awkward, I think, in the research on this stuff, which is often you'll read about how integrated schools lift up everyone, which sounds really nice, but there's a way of reading that that is like, you know, the way to save a school is to have white kids show up, which feels kind of like almost literally like white savior-y, you know, like the way, like once the white kids show up, then the school does better. Like, does that feel weird to you? Like, how do you process that?
Yeah. So, well, it was so interesting because part of the arc of this book is really me trying to figure out where should I send my kid to school. Then I think I've figured out that it would both be great for my kid and like ethical and like more moral to live in a multiracial city to send my kid to this black majority school. then I'm there and it's like wonderful and uncomfortable and all the things. And then my kids' transitionary kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Miner, who's this like brilliant, masterful teacher, Black woman, born and raised in Oakland, leaves the school after my kids' first year there. She was her teacher. And I say, hey, can I come like have a conversation with you? I'm working on this book and I would love to know what you think about it. She says, sure. She's building her own beautiful preschool in East Oakland. I show up and she said, did you mean integrating schools or gentrifying schools? And it was like, okay, we are about to have a real conversation.
So you show up and what did you guys talk about?
She just like said, she's basically very skeptical about integration. She's like, you know, my experience as a kid growing up in Oakland is that white people showed up and all of a sudden, like, you know, there's infrastructure and people care. And like, that pisses me off. And then we got into some really deep personal stuff, which was just like, in some ways, she thinks Maya, my kid, is a distraction at this school. Like, she doesn't necessarily feel like it's like benefiting all of the kids to have Maya in the classroom. She's like, yeah, I mean, your ability to contribute books, paper towels, all of the like things that sadly a public school classroom can't afford, is helpful in a very sort of basic way, right? But that from an emotional, from like even a spiritual standpoint, when she's got kids who like are dealing with all kinds of crazy shit and she's trying to show up for those kids, and then my like white daughter is like tugging on her arm being like, you know, can I get this specific kind of attention? That's actually distracting. And there's all these ways in which proximity is complicated, like at our school. So it's like school provided lunch or your kid brings a lunch. Of course, all the white kids bring their lunch and they sit down and they have their, like, you know, in Mrs. Miner's words, their bento boxes. Maya's never had a bento box for the record because I'm a shitty cook. But like, in theory, the white kids are showing up with their bento boxes and the other kids are having like school provided lunch and they sit on opposite sides of the lunch table, even at 6 and 5 years old. And like, great. So we like smushed them all together, but they're like separate and maybe even more aware of their class differences and what they're each getting that the other isn't. I mean, that started as one conversation. Then I was like, can I keep coming back? Like, are you willing to keep having this conversation? We would have it actually during the nap times at her preschool. So there'd be like, you know, 10 little babies asleep in her room because she, again, is masterful. And then we'd be in the kitchen just like hashing this shit out. And I'm just so grateful to her because we're honest with each other and we are friends at this point. I mean, she would say the same. Like, we have been in this, what I think of as kind of a democratic friendship of like, we are wrestling over some stuff. We aren't sure, like, and neither of us is sure about the virtues and limitations of integration. You know, her dream is to have beautiful Afrocentric spaces where Black kids feel like kings and queens, which is what she's created in her preschool. Like, you walk in there and you get it. Like, this is, she's built a world in this, you know, small house in East Oakland, but that she wishes the whole school district was that world, that, like, there was no question for Black and brown kids that they were deeply valued, whether white kids ever showed up or not. That's my dream, too, for Black and brown kids. That's not the reality. So tomorrow, when I have to send my kids somewhere, is it writ large useful to Black and brown kids in this city if Maya shows up at Emerson? I think so. But I don't in any way, shape, or form deny all of the like potential side effects of that.
And also, just to get really sort of basic, and it's not that, you know, there's something about white kids that means that inherently by white kids showing up, they're improving a school. It's that the way that like white kids is correlated with the school getting resources, right? I mean, just to sort of spell that out.
Yeah. Well, and just to be very clear, like, our school, Emerson, which is Title I, Black Majority School, we've been talking about, raises privately, like from families, like max $10,000. A school literally like a mile away is raising $150,000 a year from their parent population. That's $150,000 more dollars that those kids at that school get. It's invested in them. They get an innovation lab. They have a full-time art teacher. They have a library that can be open 5 days a week. Imagine. They maybe have like a nurse on staff. Like, these are real things that affect kids' real lives. So, like, there's nothing magic about it. It's, like, absolute bullshit. But it's, like, when white people show up, money shows up. and money makes a difference. Like, and you know, this is again a like short-term versus long-term thing. Schools should be funded completely differently. Like that is, I would argue we should abolish PTAs and abolish private fundraising at public schools. But until that happens, tomorrow, like kids are showing up to schools and like who's going to be able to donate money?
Totally, yeah. Well, that's one, I mean, we don't need to go off on this tangent, but this exact thing is something we will be embarking on with our kids in, I don't know, a year and a half. And so I was like very close to it, knowing you and also knowing that I was going to go through this myself, this whole like process. And yeah, it definitely, I mean, one way of talking about it, right, when I report on the right and the far right, there are very many like disingenuous, specious ways that they like to critique progressives. Progressives are very easy to lampoon. But one of the better arguments that they make is around some of this stuff, the performativity or the phrase that you always hear, the phrase virtue signaling. And one thing that I was always trying to tease apart when I was looking through that critique is, what is the difference between, like, they call everything virtue signaling. But I was like, at some point, some things have to be not virtue signaling, but just actual attempts at virtue, right? And I think one of the things that you're getting at is that when you're only talking at the level of speech, whether it's social media or just like a big virtual room where everybody's doing nothing but talking and showing pixels of what they're thinking, then it's all virtue signaling because it's all signaling. But when you actually move into the realm of doing something, whether it's living in a different place or putting yourself or your child in a different place or spending your money in a different way or whatever it is, then you move out of the realm of signaling and into the realm of like whether what you're doing is perfectly virtuous or not. That's a separate question, but at least you're doing something, right?
Yeah, I love that way of putting it. And that also brings up another piece that I don't know if this helps, which is like part of what I'm wrestling with is the secular nature of like a white moral life, because I'm not a religious person, I'm agnostic. And like most of the context for like what a white moral life means contemporarily are religious based. Like I'd meet Christian people and they'd be like, yeah, we're interested in living differently. Like we go and serve coffee to unhoused folks in Oakland. We have real conversations with them. We're like doing these things. And I was like, that sounds really relational and like important and edifying and interesting and like so much better than like me figuring out whether I should post my black square on Instagram, you know. Wish I had some like larger, you know, sort of like discipline and framework to fall back on in this moral moment. I got nothing. I got like Robin DiAngelo and like whatever. It's like it's very anemic. Like and so that, I guess to your point, Andrew, like the virtue signaling, like signal is shallow. And so how do I give this testimony as just like social proof that this is something I did, you might be interested, but it's not signal. It's like a real attempt at living a different way. But, you know, the beauty of the choice we made is Maya's in this beautiful community, which is not as highly resourced as other communities, but she has great friends, she has fantastic teachers, her curiosity is being fed. There are certain things she's probably not getting exposure to in the same way as other kids are. I don't even know. Academically, she might suffer. I like, you know, the studies don't show that, but like my experience of her is that like she's not reading super well, or like there are certain things that maybe if she was at one of these highly resourced schools, she'd be like reading better and writing better. And I have no idea, but I'm really leaning into this faith that all of that stuff is going to come out in the wash. Mm-hmm. But like, the things that have stuck with me about my parents, who were progressive people who really tried to instill important values in me, were their contradictions at different moments of like, why did you say these things, but we lived this way? Maya will certainly say that about various things. But in this case, she might be like, that was kind of interesting that you guys did that. Like, and that intrigues me. That excites me.
Andrew Marantz is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he spoke with Courtney Martin, whose new book is Learning in Public.